passing around some stuff I'm going to refer to in just a second. First item that I want to tell you about, our TPWD Law Enforcement Forensic Laboratory is currently in the process of becoming the only accredited wildlife forensic laboratory in the U.S. at the state level. The lab recently was inspected as part of the accreditation process. Upon completion of the process, the lab will be fully accredited by the American Society of Crime Lab Directors. TPWD has closed another license buyback application period, closed March 31st of 2006, for commercial bay and bait shrimp and commercial finfish boat licenses. In the 18th round for the shrimp buyback, we accepted 119 bids, 60 bay and 59 bait licenses, from 179 applicants in this round. If all of these contracts are completed, the cost of purchasing these licenses will be $932,000 and some change, average cost of about $7,800 for that buyback round. Now, the example that I passed to you is just an interesting piece of information. I specifically asked Doc to stay handy in case you want to know very much detail about it. But we got this from our coastal fishery guys last week. And what it shows you there is the bottom line is the number of boats that are out shrimping on opening day over the last 14-year, 12-year period. And it tells quite a story. And I wanted to share that with you. Doc will be talking about this some more later on as we get into the year and about where we're going to go to, what we're going to do in the future. Commissioner Brown is very involved in our coastal fisheries issues, and it is really a dramatic drop. 50, am I right, Doc? 57 total boats this year out. And there were some weather conditions, but sometimes there are weather conditions other years also. But the difference in something just under 900 boats out 12 years ago, in the direct steady decline to 57 boats out this year is dramatic.
Great trend.
And some would say a great trend.
Well, look at the trend, and Larry Craven's on long, look at the trend in game space survey numbers. If you plotted that against this graph, it's a good story all the way around. But Larry, you've heard me ask this question before, and it's one to, if there is an update on it. I think Commissioner Ramos and I both, I think, have made the point that we shouldn't be spending the money on inactive licenses in the buyback. And can you tell me how that's going, that we're pursuing some sort of...
One of the things that we put into play is what's called a trip ticket system, and that is a way for us finally to actually get effort reports from individual fishermen. Up to this date, we've only been able to get that information from the fish houses themselves, that type of thing. So as we put this system in, as we gather that information, we will be able to accumulate data on an individual license holder and how much they fish or don't fish. And that will give us a basis for seeing whether how active you are, and actually developing a system of priorities and funding as to how much we would be willing to pay for a particular license. The only fly in that ointment is, of course, that you have to be careful of, which confounds things at this point, is those licenses aren't transferable. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to get in a situation where you have someone who's selling their license for a high fee and going buying a low license, that type of thing, because they are transferable. And so that's an issue we'll always have to deal with or have to go through some legislative work with, perhaps, to address before you can be very effective at that. But we'll get the information together to do it.
Doc, as I recall, one of the, and again, some history here for these commissioners, the stated goal in buyback was to get that number something below 400. Am I remembering?
That was one goal that was set during the legislative session of my group that was dealing with that. Our goal has always been to get the effort down into something like the 70 or something like that. We looked at that effort was something that would be sustainable, that would still supply the bait shrimp that you need for the recreational industry. You got to balance that off. But it's clearly, if it's not there now, it's heading there. And of course, what our concern is that we somehow make sure that what we would call that latent capacity is taken off the table. That inactive group, we would like to get them off, so that if conditions ever turned around, it didn't come back up.
So, well, couldn't you take care of that problem of not getting the reduced impact? You know, the whole idea of buying active licenses is to make sure that the money being spent is being spent to remove an impact on the bat.
Really?
What you're saying is somebody can go buy an inactive license to replace that, and you've not really reduced the impact because the other one was inactive. And it seems to me, and I know Commissioner Ronaldson had discussed this before, that the way to handle that is to deal with the renewal process of the inactive.
We don't have that. No, that's a statutory issue.
That's a statutory issue.
You have to go to the legislature. And I think there's a point, though, that you come at when we have the data and we can actually go to. And the legislature is very concerned, and you understand that when someone has a license and they're a shrimper and that's their business, the legislature is very reluctant to go in and just take that person's business away, just to take it away. But if you go to the legislature at a certain point with data that shows this license hasn't been used, I mean, this is not it's just being held. Then you have a much. It makes that case. Yeah. So I think you have a much better case. And they say, look, we're not trying to deal with those people that are trying to make a living. There's a group of licenses here that are inactive, and we need to get them out of that market and move forward. So I think
well, one way to maybe deal with that, that I'd like you to consider, has been successful in offshore with transferable quotas in other fisheries, is to cap. And I know we're not granting any licenses.
That's correct.
But theoretically, we could, correct?
Well, we have. We've capped the number of licenses. We do not issue any. Whatever licenses we have now are steadily shrinking. About 45% of them are now gone. We've cut them in half.
And then if we've capped on that side, but then the loophole still is you can hold an inactive license for speculative purposes, then if we eliminate that by requiring use for renewal, I wish I had Montgomery here, my University of Chicago economist, doesn't that increase the value of the active license?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay.
Makes it very valuable.
So I would think that the community of active commercial fishermen would want the value of their license to be greater.
Well, in line with that, the way I approach it is if you have a license but it's inactive, you have effectually abandoned the permit, correct? So to me it would make sense either legislatively or otherwise that those inactive licenses be considered to be abandoned to where they automatically fall out of the system and you don't impact those that have an active license. Then our true focus should be with the active licenses. And I agree with Joe. We shouldn't let people just sit on licenses as an investment. The whole purpose of the license is to use it, and to the extent you're not using it, you have effectively abandoned it.
Do I understand it, Doc, that the licenses are perpetual?
As long as you come in and buy another one the next year, within the year. Renewable.
They're automatically renewable.
No, they're not. You have to do
that. I mean, you have to come in
and sign and get it.
And is the condition on which it's renewed legislatively mandated? Or can we condition
only that
renewal?
They can. I don't think, because anything would say that they couldn't get their license other than just coming in. And if they had one in the past, they're eligible to buy another one. That's the basic.
Don't have to be in compliance with Coast Guard regulations,
rules and those kinds of things. And there are ways.
Are their boats inspected?
No, not as a requirement. Mm-hmm.
The license is to the individual.
Yes.
Not to the boat.
Not to the boat, it's the individual, which is one of the problems with the game.
It's an interesting topic. It's one of importance. And I think what's driving this thing? I mean, there's still 800 some odd folks out there that buy licenses. Mm-hmm. 57 of them went fishing on opening day. $3 fuel. And the price of shrimp is driving this thing so much more than
than we ever thought it would. Times have changed. And yeah. That's kind of where we wanted
to. That keeps changing. Shrimp tariffs, which they've gone and missed.
And so we're going to be looking at all this.
We can put on the agenda maybe next meeting.
That's your first strategy.
Sir, it is on the. We plan not on it now, but we do plan to expand on this and give you some opportunities.
And the money we use for the buyback comes from the saltwater.
Two sources: the saltwater, the $3 surcharge that we that you all continue, and a percentage of those commercial licenses that we sell also goes to buyback.
Mr. Chairman. Would an approach to the legislature be to maybe if we could offer, right now we're not offering any new licenses, correct?
All of our commercial licenses and all aspects of commercial fisheries is not a limited, basically limited entry.
Limited entry.
To protect those people who might want to buy a new license, to protect them from the black market of buying from someone who has a license. Like the legislature wants to protect that person from a black market pressure.
I'm not sure where the black market is. If it's cap and trade, if it's a limited entry, then you're giving value to the existing licenses. And they can sell or transfer that license to us, to the CCA Foundation, to whoever they want.
They can't transfer it to another person?
I don't know if
that's
a black market.
At a market.
And whatever they can sell it at. So.
Well, philosophically, I don't have a problem with that, because then that means that the most efficient operator is going to pay the highest price to an inefficient operator to take them up. That doesn't...
Under these fuel prices and these shrimp prices, that license didn't work very much on the transfer.
There's not a whole lot of people out there beating people's door down.
We're the best buyer, right? We're the best market at $7,800.
But to the extent that we have the jurisdiction to set conditions upon which we can renew a license, we could make it a conditional renewal that, in fact, there has been historical usage of that. And to the extent, and that eliminates the person that is just buying them for purposes of having an inventory of licenses for the future. And it seems to me that was not the purpose to acquire the license. The purpose was to use it. And to me, it would be very reasonable to make it a condition of renewal that there has been a historical use of that license.
That would require some statutory generation.
How many licenses are we buying back every year?
Well, this round, 17 round, was our record of about 100, I think. It was usually 50 to 70, something like that.
And to what extent is there any trading of licenses that we know of that does not involve Parks and Wildlife?
I can't. There is some. There's no doubt, because we do get changes in applications and proposals. If it does happen, I can't tell you. I can probably get some information for you. And the briefing we do in August, I'll try to do that. I'll put that down and get you some information. Off the top of my head, I can't.
Because I've got to believe that we are the buyer.
As far as buying licenses...
For $7,800, I can't imagine somebody...
You'll have some people in trading. The licenses are set by boat size. And so there's some trading up and down of people getting different sizes of boats and trades. So there's some of that. We'll brief you fully.
We are the buyer, but I think what's important here to remember is that we're paying for it with the dollars of the recreational angler who's the beneficiary, which makes a lot of sense. Okay. Any other? I know we're going to get another update on that. Thanks, Larry.
That's a good debate.
That's it?
Yes.
Yep, do it. Of course. Yeah. Okay. Item two, coordination of fish and game agencies. I have Commissioner Parker and Scott Bohr.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, once again for the record, my name is Scott Bora, Deputy Executive Director of Operations. My pleasure today to introduce Commissioner John Parker, who's going to brief you gentlemen on a meeting he attended in Arkansas back in late April. Yes, that's correct. Back in late April, a multi-state commission meeting where commissioners from, I believe, seven states came together and discussed common issues relative to conservation. And with that, I'll hand it over to Mr. Park.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. First off, I want to thank one person that has done a bang-up job on this presentation, and that's Marion Edwards. She is a whiz at putting one of these things together. She and I worked most of the day yesterday. She's a whiz on that computer. I mean, she switched things around and did it so fast and made my head swim. I have several items for one copied item for you to keep and several items to pass around and look at them just to give you an idea of the generosity of the Arkansas Game and Fish Foundation who sponsored this event. Okay, the picture that you see here is all of the attendees from the various states. Now, Louisiana didn't show and didn't call in as to why. Mississippi had a commission meeting, and they could not attend. But attending were Arkansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas with myself. I want to tell my fellow commissioners that you missed one heck of a good party and meeting. The one of the books that Ned is going to be passing around to you has a lot of pictures in it taken down in the Arkansas, southeast duck country of Arkansas. And just a little side note, those pictures depicted in there were taken by a fellow by the name of Ed Queenie, who was a bombardier on a B-24 during World War II, and he took those pictures with a camera that came out of a B-24. Incredible waterfowl pictures, and every duck you see in there is a mallard. And then he and Ted Bishop conspired and produced one of the first coffee table books, and it was produced for the benefit of Ducks Unlimited in 1948. Little side story to that book. Anyhow, it was a great meeting, and I put together this report, and I want you to read this very carefully. This is one thing that I added. This report is not being presented to criticize any facet program or staff of TPWD, because TPWD has established many programs that other states are now copying. I'm going to present to you four ideas that I gleaned from this meeting. The most important one, in my opinion, was the interscholastic clay target shooting program that Tennessee started. The others, the cost-saving relationship with the USDA between Missouri, Oklahoma, and the USDA in the NRCS program. The elk hunting programs of Oklahoma and Arkansas and Tennessee. And this one, we didn't know how to title it, so we just titled it Trout Stocking in Arkansas. But there were some other ideas that other states talked about, and we'll get to those in a moment. First of all, with the scholastic clay target shooting program in Tennessee, it was started after the tragic shooting incident in Jonesboro, Arkansas, which is in eastern Arkansas, close to Tennessee. And the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency commissioners saw an opportunity to counteract and possibly make something good out of something bad. The commissioners sat down and brainstormed about what they could do to prevent such a tragedy from happening in Tennessee. Their first thought was of the 4-H shooting sports program, and we have that in Texas, and how it could be taken to the next level in the context of education. They decided that what public school children need is to completely understand sporting guns and their uses. This was the whole reason for establishing this program in the Tennessee school system. And this shooting, play target shooting program, is now a UIL scholastic program with the Tennessee school, public school agency, like our Texas Education Agency. In 2004, the state of Tennessee and Tennessee Wildlife Foundation got involved. As you can see, the next year, the number of shooters went up. Tennessee's Wildlife Resources Agency put in $120,000 into the program. In 2004, they put in $100,000 in 2005 and $250,000 in 2006. Most of this money has been used to start shooting facilities and build trap deals. Some funds went into buying clays for startup teams, and they were weaned off the support. I have a short 4-minute video that explains their program, and I want you to notice that, let's say, we'll call him the star young man of this program. If he was in this room today, he would be reading my lips. He is totally hearing impaired. And also, I want to add here also that next year, in 07, the Amateur Trap Association in Vandalia, Ohio, will include a division for UIL interscholastic competition for high school students in their great American trap shooting national championships. Okay, roll that down.
Besides the sporty straw hat, there's something that sets Joshua Wilman apart from the competition. His parents, you receive.
They wouldn't know that.
Not a problem, no doubt. And Joshua is clearly a good shooter. So are all these other kids trying to win a state championship when he plays on the play card at home.
He's
amazing. He has a jet. He drives and he probably doesn't feel like driving. And he keeps on that. He keeps on that. But what makes Joshua unique doesn't really have anything to do with his shooting skills.
He came back and said, he's an unknown client, but he's got no money. He's got a little bit. He bought the concert title, but he wanted to continue with his kids, have a ball. You know, that's just the thing you have in everybody. I'm just telling my kids to get with you.
And Joshua stands in support of what the coordinators of this event have been saying for years. This is a sport just about anybody.
Small schools are competitive with big schools. It doesn't take a big staff person or a strong person or a jump or, you know, anything they can do.
I think it's pretty cool. I think it's one of the best things I've ever got in, but
it's been a godsend. He has played American youth soccer. I feel he was just 10 and it became a little too competitive for him to let himself. So we were looking for something that, you know, to keep him busy, keep him occupied, and that he enjoyed. And it was the perfect sport for him.
More and more schools are figuring out that shooting sports are an important extracurricular activity. Over 4 years, the state championship event has grown from just 5 shooters to 16 to 132, and now 260.
It is closer than I suspect. Within just a few years, we'll have 1,000 plus kids, I think.
You probably figured out by now, if you didn't know already, there's some really special kids out here today. And you know, you might not have thought of it like this before, but these are student athletes, like basketball, baseball, and football. You're right, Mom and Dad, we know what that means. Maybe a scholarship. I got sent to a little one at the university at St. Paul's, Missouri. It's right out of St. Louis. And I will be on the shooting program. I'll be shooting with all the disciplines, 40 play, feet, international feet, American trap, and international trap, and I got scholarship there. College scholarship fulfills one dream for George Nelson, but now he's got a dream.
I like to make that Olympic team and shoot for our country and Olympics someday.
For others, the goal is very simple. Having your hat blown if you're the ring is a rite of passage for a Olympic school.
That is the greater school, Mr. White. Josh with me for Morristown High School is the first place winner in the Xperia in the division. And his parents have the joy of watching their son live the values they taught.
He has been one of the most special human beings.
Nobody knew he was out here in college that year. Nobody picked him out of the crowd. He deals with it every day. And he does a wonderful job. He uplifts other people, even sometimes in his family. He's a miracle kid.
I'm Steve Hall, Montana Steve Wildstock. Steve Hall? Catch that? Steve Hall? Steve Hall?
Okay, out of 98 counties, you can see here, 60 participated in the program, 150 separate schools, 30% of the teams are 4-H teams. Volunteers are key to the success, and regional directors are responsible for different regions. Requiring each shooter to be Hunter Ed certified builds a new outdoor recruiting pool, as evidenced by the poll of Tennessee shooters. Of those who previously never bought a license, get this now. There are 1,700 kids in the program this year after 4 years. So they went from 16 to 1,700. Of the 1,700, 85% of those children had never bought a hunting license before in their life. Today, 85% of those children are hunting license buyers, and 60% of their parents had never bought licenses, and now their parents are buying hunting licenses. It's an in-school UIL program, just like it's for the kids that can't play football or basketball or be cheerleaders or whatever, but they can hold a shotgun and participate junior high and high school. It's a sport for anybody, student athletes with opportunities for college scholarships. And here we are in Texas, and what brought this home to me, down in San Antonio, we've got the largest clay target shooting facility in the world. Okay, the next idea that I gleaned was a program that the state of Missouri started first, and then Oklahoma is coming into it now. 93% of the state is privately owned. It's just like Texas. The MDC focuses on restoration of critical habitats and landscapes on private land. Our land steward program that's coming tonight. This is a worthwhile project in the close working cost-saving relationship between Missouri and Oklahoma natural resource agencies with the USDA is, and this is a new word, this is from East Texas, with USDA in officing their wildlife biologists in the same offices with the NRCS. In other words, they worked a deal in Missouri where they would put a wildlife biologist habitat manager in the same office as the NRCS, and now the NRCS is paying part of that person's salary. The NRCS, they're paying for the office space, a desk, a chair, file cabinets, a computer, a telephone, and really, When farmers, ranchers, and new recreational landowners walk into the USDA office, then they get the opportunity to meet one of their wildlife specialists at the same time. To me, that's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel. The partnership in Missouri began in 1981. The MDC biologists train NRCS field staff and service landowner and service landowner requests. The NRCS has contributed $145 million to the MDC each year since 2002 Farm Bill was implemented. The funding to achieve fish, forest, and wildlife objectives on private land. Now then, in Oklahoma, They started a little bit later in 1998, but they're on board with the NRCS. Oklahoma's private land technicians review WIP applications, conduct on-site visits, rank projects, provide technical guidance, and develop management plans for the approved projects for the people who come into the NRCS office. I understand that our staff has been working closely with Texas State Conservationist Dr. Larry Butler in Temple to develop and initiate a similar program in Texas. Our Farm Bill Coordinator is Chuck Kowaleski, and he has been doggedly pursuing such an arrangement. So far, NRCS funds have not been available to allow this arrangement in Texas. But we have, keep in mind, that Texas has one position in one NRCS office in the entire state, and we have 254 counties. Missouri has 53 for 114 counties. They do not put their people in the metropolitan NRCS offices. This program would give us one more tool to supplement and support our land stewardship program and could possibly put it on the fast track. Elk restoration and hunting programs. There's some interesting ideas here. Elk rank just below deer and turkey in terms of big game hunter numbers. Elk licenses sold in the U.S. and Canada increased, and this was a shocker to me, increased from 500,000 in 1975 to 950,000 in 1995. That's just a doubling in 20 years. And of all of these projects that I'm going to talk about to you about the elk in these various states, there have been no occurrence of CWD in the sampled elk herds. Elk are also a popular part of wildlife watching. We have bird watching. We also have elk watching. The 1990 study of Montana indicated that wildlife viewing annually contributed more than $44 million to Montana's economy. Elk viewing is very popular in Montana, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Michigan and Pennsylvania are states, along with Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, that have reintroduced elk to their former eastern USA range. Elk and white-tailed deer are non-competitive ruminants. That is not an East Texas word. I got that from Marion Edwards. Elk are grazers, and deer are browsers. The Arkansas elk restoration originally occurred in Arkansas, and the eastern elk originally occurred in Arkansas and eastern U.S. There are no records of eastern elk in Arkansas beyond 1840. An attempt was made in the Ozark region in the 1930s, but that failed. A second restoration attempt in the Ozark in the early 1980s was successful. 112 Rocky Mountain elk were stocked between 1981 and 85. These elk were trapped in Colorado and Nebraska and transported to Arkansas in stock trailers. All of the elk were stocked in Newton County near the Buffalo National River. The herd has increased in number and distribution. The program relies heavily on habitat restoration and management of the herd. Harvested elk are sampled for diseases such as CWD, brucellosis, and that's not an East Texas word either, disease. No evidence of CWD or other disease problems in this herd thus far. And there is a graph there that shows the steady climb with a little dip in there of the elk population by cow and calf. And I realize it might be hard to read, but the point is that the numbers are definitely going up. And the next slide that we're going to show is the mortalities of the elk herd in Arkansas. Again, no evidence of CWD. Unfortunately, the biggest problem that they have are the poachers. The Arkansas elk harvest. 188 elk have been harvested in Arkansas since 1988. This includes 82 antlered bulls and 106 cows. The total harvest in 2005 decreased primarily due to a decreased harvest in the private land hunting zone. Both of the hunts in 2005 went well with few problems encountered by the commission. Comments from hunters were positive and they were very appreciative of the opportunity to hunt elk in Arkansas. Now then, to the Oklahoma program. An elk permit is available through public hunt drawing to hunt in the Wichita Mountains National Wildlife Refuge. The number of bull and cow permits issued each year is dependent on the population levels. Due to high demand, for these hunts, individuals may be drawn only once during their lifetime. And then the next shows that they have done a steady process of testing for disease, and none have tested positive. Oklahoma elk hunting on private lands. Deer and elk are monitored for CWD again, even on the private lands. Mandatory checking of deer offers sufficient means of collecting samples statewide. The deer processors taking in the elk are very cooperative in providing specimens for testing. Over 5,500 free-ranging elk and deer have been tested, and here again, non-positive. Now then, Tennessee has just started their elk restoration program. The last recorded elk in Tennessee was in 1865. They started by releasing elk from the Elk Island National Park in Alberta, Canada, which is one of the most famous parks for taking elk to be transplanted in other areas. Elk from best source. Tennessee may also consider obtaining elk from Utah or the elk and bison enclosure at Lamb between the lakes in Minnesota. It is also hoped that some mature cows that will probably be pregnant, which will ultimately augment the numbers of the animals released, causing the Tennessee elk population to grow. Going to the next slide. Now, one thing that I do want to point out, the restoration zone is 670,000 acres in Tennessee. Mostly it's in eastern Tennessee and in the Smoky Mountains. Potential to cause crop damage and property damage to row crops. Elk that wander outside the zone, they are captured or destroyed. Restoration zone has few farms but does contain suitable habitat to support a large herd. They expect the population of elk to go from 400 to 1,400 in 16 years. All elk released in Tennessee and Arkansas and Oklahoma are fitted with radio collars to track movements. When patterns of herd movements are established, the public is notified for viewing areas. Arkansas and Oklahoma give the first elk license each year to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation to be auctioned. These funds support the restoration efforts. Tennessee plans to do the same thing with their first season in 2007. The fourth idea is that of Arkansas's trout stocking program in the streams and rivers and what it has done to that country's economic situation for landowners where the rivers and streams either run through their property or border their property. Arkansas saw a need to expand its trout stocking program to support private landowners where streams and rivers run through or border their property. This has resulted in a major increase of resort fishing industry along these streams and rivers. Our Inland Fisheries Division does a wonderful job of stocking trout in the winter here in Texas. But they're stocked only in the cold months, and when the warm months come, then they go away. Perhaps we could look at heavily stocking certain areas of our rivers and streams with larger size catfish, crappie, bass, and bream, thus creating an opportunity for entry-level anglers and a resource industry for the landowners on each side of the streams and river. Quite probably, maybe a practical and more definitive approach would be for several targeted areas for local surveys of private landowners along those streams and rivers here in Texas to find out if those owners would be interested in trying to establish a fishing industry along the banks of their rivers on their private lands. And with that, that is the end of my presentation, and I'll tell you for sure, if they invite me back up there, we stayed at the Gaston Lodge, there right below Bull Shoals Dam. It's a magnificent thing. One morning, I did not go on the fishing trip, but those guys were catching brown trout, you know, this long. The opening picture of everybody standing there on the bank was at another resort. And they cooked the fish they caught over an open fire there on the bank, and we had beautiful blackberry cobbler with ice cream and all the trimmings in between. And it was a magnificent trip, and I would certainly encourage if they do it again next year for some of you to go. Thank you. Thank you, Marion.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John. Looks like you're having all the fun, John.
It was a fun trip.
We're going to send you to a public meeting on what's Quint or something to balance that out.
Managed vendor permit.
Yeah, managed vendor permit. We'll send you a
or maybe
not managed land elk permit. No lips.
On catfish? What? On catfish?
Yeah. There you go. Okay, thanks very much, John. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you representing the commission at that meeting. Next up, item 3, Migratory Game Bird Proclamation, Vernon Bevel.
Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Vernon Bevel. I'm the program director for small game and habitat assessment. And I'm here today to kind of give you an overview of what we see coming down the road in the months ahead for migratory bird seasons and regulations for 2006-2007. The process got underway pretty significantly during our March meeting of the Central Flyway Council, and all four of the Flyway Councils meet, and our recommendations have been passed on to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and in the month of June we will have the early season regulation meeting with Fish and Wildlife Service to formalize early season proposals across the country. We have several significant changes. We're looking at all of our significant changes are late season. Other than that, we're looking at pretty much standard calendar shift and that sort of thing. A lot of the work being done to help us finalize the regulation process is taking place now with breeding population surveys and habitat surveys, both for doves across the country and for waterfowl in our prairie pothole region north of us. We have three significant proposals for late season regulations that I'll talk about in more detail a little later in this presentation, but one includes a hunter choice option, which I briefly discussed with you at a previous meeting. We're potentially thinking about the repeal of the light goose conservation order, and we potentially may get a one bird increase in the Canada goose limit in the Western Goose Zone. For doves, we don't anticipate any changes over last year other than calendar shift. White wing season, the same thing. You will recall that we had that increase in the size of the special white wing zone southwest of San Antonio last year. That went very well. The aggregate bag is 12 birds, no more than 4 mourning doves or 2 white-tipped doves in that aggregate bag during the special white wing season. And we don't anticipate any change there.
Before you leave that, what is it going to take for us to get over to 37? Because I know that was the bridge too far last year.
Probably don't take an act of Congress.
But an act of Congress? Okay, don't push your luck.
It would take significant resources to do the population analysis work that would need to be done, and that is a matter of prioritizing budgets to do so. and whether or not that is a high enough priority in the grand scheme of things that we that the gain is worth the effort.
Is that a mourning dove nesting issue?
It's a mourning dove nesting issue. We've had mourning dove nesting work done in this state many years ago, and the nesting results indicate a fairly significant portion of our birds fledge after September the 1st. That's why that's delayed. Go back to this slide. We don't know for sure what our opportunities will be for teal, but if it's a 9-day season, it would be the 16th through the 24th, and a 16-day season would be the 9th through the 24th. We take the last full weekend in September, whether it's a 9-day or a 16-day season. It's either 2 weekends or 3 weekends. These are the calendar shift proposal for the other early season species. We have 3 waterfowl zones in duck zones in the state of Texas. We don't anticipate a change from the liberal package, but we don't know that for sure at this point in time. Habitat conditions in prairie pothole country seem to be better this year than they were last year, so we hope that combined with the breeding population surveys will help us to another liberal package, but that won't be determined for another month or so yet. And under the liberal package we've been operating from, we have a 6-bird bag with some species restrictions within that 6-bird bag. Last year, you will recall that to protect black ducks, mottled ducks, and Mexican ducks, we went to a 1 dusky duck aggregate bag limit to help solve that problem. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that and canvasbacks and pintail, which are under that 39-day restricted season as part of this hunter's choice bag. The Central Flyway has been working with the Fish and Wildlife Service for several years to resolve a regulatory complexity issue where we've got these restricted seasons within seasons, closed seasons like we have experienced for canvasback and that sort of thing, and we've come up with a game plan that we call hunter's choice, and that's to take the mallard hen and put the mallard hen in with pintails and canvasback and dusky ducks. And the mallard hen is a buffer so that we can hunt season-long these species. But when a hunter takes one of that species combination, his day is over. But he's not then restricted to remember when did that 39-day season start. So we think that's an opportunity. And if we get the hunter choice option approved within the Central Flyway, we are in a mandatory scenario to take hunter's choice. The one thing it does do is reduces the overall bag from 6 to 5 in the liberal package, and it combines those species, as I said, in that aggregate 1-bird bag.
Mm.
Yes, sir.
What is a dusky duck?
It's a definition we came up with last year to protect mottled ducks, which are under increasing scrutiny for concerns for their breeding population across the West Gulf coastal region. We have a number of people who are taking multiple ducks and trying to say they're either model ducks or Mexican ducks or black ducks. And the dusky duck helps us buffer against an overharvest of model ducks primarily.
So a dusky duck is either one of the
is
three.
Is a brown duck in the mallard, in that overall mallard genus group. Yeah. The western goose zone and the eastern, did I adequately answer? The western goose zone, the eastern goose zone, we basically anticipate calendar shift. I would note that under the western goose zone bag limit, we are hopeful of gaining a fourth Canada goose in the bag. Right now we're dealing with a 4-bird bag, but it's limited to 3 Canada geese. So we pose this and the population levels are sufficient to sustain that. Hopefully the service will approve it. Basically calendar shift for the eastern goose zone this year. Recently, the Fish and Wildlife Service had a scoping meeting in Rosenberg where they were looking at waterfowl issues for an upcoming evaluation of the EIS on hunting of migratory birds. And there was some discussion at that meeting about among hunters that the light goose conservation season had lost popularity and concern that our population on the coastal region of Texas. That declined some, probably as a result of the effort we made to reduce that population. And so there was some noise level there that the light goose conservation season is not effective, and perhaps we should just disband it for the period ahead. So in order to get some good feedback from our goose hunting public, we would like to go out with a proposal to cancel that light goose conservation order and see if that is in fact the preponderance of the noise level that's out there among our goose hunting population. Then we can come back to you in August with a formal recommendation to either keep it or drop it. And if we drop it, then we expand a few opportunities for other species.
You can't work a trade with the feds on that?
No. No, it's in law. We can either have it or not have it, but there's...
Go back to that other slide, though. Was that the exposure up on the breeding grounds?
I would tell you that the light goose numbers are still just about as high as they've ever been.
So the conservation order has not been effective in reducing the numbers and thereby improving the habitat?
We think they've reduced the numbers that we were trying to reduce in Texas because our breeding population survey on the coast has declined from an all-time high of the 90s.
The objective is to try and conserve that habitat that you see on the lake that's up in the Northwest Territories.
The adaptability of the snow goose has been something that we have been struggling with. And one of the reasons the numbers are still high is that they're wintering in new areas that they didn't winter in before. And they're breeding in new areas that didn't breed in before. But they are a menace to a number of species. But at the same time, the tools that have been available to us in Texas, probably not the tools we need to get the job done.
Thank you, sir.
So anyway, we would like to go out and make this proposal a formal proposal so that we can get the feedback and know what we need to do to recommend to you all in August when you have that time to make that decision.
Vernon has lost his voice.
It's a first, isn't it?
This is surprising to you.
Who handed him the water?
I did.
I've lost my voice two other times in presentations and professional meetings, believe it or not. The Sandhill Crane proposal is basically the same as last year. If we don't go with the light goose conservation season, we actually get to extend the back end of the Sandhill Crane season in zone A and B a little bit, so we gain a few days of Sandhill Crane. And that covers my presentation. I'll be glad if I can talk to answer any questions.
I'll make this as easy as I can. There's a hunter opportunity benefit to doing away with the light goose conservation one?
No.
That is?
We,
what, essentially?
Well, we don't really think that there will be a fall off in hunting opportunity per se or a fall off in harvest. Because the popularity based on our surveys, we've been doing an annual survey post conservation order, and the number of participants have steadily declined since the beginning of it, the early few years. And we do gain a little bit on the Sandhill Crane season.
Any other questions for Vernon? I don't want to torture Vernon a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vernon. No action required there. Next up, item number 4, proposed amendment to harmful, potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, and aquatic plant regulations. Jody?
Chairman, committee members, my name is Jody Gray, and I'm a staff support specialist with Inland Fisheries. The Commission has established rules to regulate the importation, possession, sale, and placement in the water of this state any harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, or aquatic plants. Staff is proposing amendments to these rules which will provide additional protection to our native aquatic species and provide consistency and clarification for certain provisions of the rules. Staff is proposing adding two exotic Chinese carp to the prohibited fish list. These carp have the potential to cause negative ecological impacts if accidentally released into state waters. Brown gobies have invaded the Great Lakes, causing ecological damage to native fish species. Therefore, staff proposes adding round gobies to our prohibited fish list. Chinese perches have been added because of their cold tolerance and potential to compete with our native bass. Staff proposes prohibiting all species of temperate basses except striped bass, white bass, yellow bass, and hybrids between the approved species. Staff is proposing the following changes to the prohibited shellfish list. The prohibition on crayfish has been expanded to include all southern hemisphere crayfishes. Some species of Australian crayfishes would represent a major ecological threat if released in Texas. Therefore, it is prudent to restrict them now before they become prevalent in the aquaculture or pet industries. Additionally, the prohibition on apple snails and giant ram's horn snails has been expanded to include all but one species, which is currently popular in the pet industry. To maintain consistency with the USDA and the Texas Department of Agriculture regulations, eight species of plants have been added to our prohibited plant list. Finally, water spinach has been added to the list of exotic species that are permitted to culture in Texas. Water spinach has been cultured for over 20 years in the Houston area. Extensive habitat surveys by staff biologists revealed no evidence of water spinach in public waters. Therefore, staff recommends that current culture facilities be allowed to continue operating under a permit from the department. Staff first seeks approval to publish these proposed amendments in the Texas Register for public comment. In addition, staff would like to mention a potential future proposal involving aquaculture. Aquaculturists or fish farmers importing, culturing, and selling exotic fish, shellfish, or aquatic plants currently abide by our prohibited list. However, if an exotic species is not on our prohibited list, it can legally be cultured without a permit from the department. Fish farmers currently check first with the department when they are considering a new species, but they are not required to do so by law. Staff will be examining the possibility of having a non-prohibited list or a list of department-approved species for aquaculture. This would require fish farmers to provide the department with a risk analysis first when applying to culture new exotic species. Staff feels this is necessary due to recent requests from fish farmers for exotic marine fish and plant species and the high probability of offshore aquaculture in Texas. Over the next few months, staff will be meeting with representatives of the aquaculture industry to obtain their input into this process. Our goal is to come back to you in the near future with a proposal for new rules addressing this issue. And, take any questions.
Any questions for Jody?
I have a dumb question. What's a temperate bass?
Striped bass.
Striped bass? Yeah.
White bass and yellow bass. And any hybrid between those two.
My only concern is educating the public to be able to know the difference between these species, but that's part of the education process, I guess.
Yeah. We have posters and booklets on identification of native species in Texas, and those fish are evident in those.
Which temperate bass were prohibited then? Because you accepted white bass, striped bass.
Any bass in that family, say like white perch, something that's not native to Texas would be prohibited.
Peacock.
That's not a
bass.
Not a bass.
Yeah,
that's all I've got. Yeah. He's out of his area, isn't he? Still.
What was that?
Never mind.
So, trying to add a little to the name.
Do the catfish fall anywhere?
If it doesn't score Ben and Crockett, we just don't need to listen to what is that what you're saying, John?
Okay.
Smart man.
Any other questions for Jody? Thank you, Jody. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 5, status of flounder. Larry McKinney.
Bought my own water.
Did you?
Me and Vernon maybe second the same thing. Apologize in advance. Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, I'm Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries. At your last meeting, and we were giving you a briefing on the status of overall fishery on the coast, a couple of questions came up about flounder and perhaps status of game fish and that type of thing. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of give you some background on flounder and the status of that fishery and where we are. So I'll do that. To start with, there are some aspects of the biology of the flounder and its life history that has some management implications, so I thought I would touch on those just briefly. The southern flounder is the largest, as it says here, the 23 flatfish that occur in Texas. This species is distributed from South Carolina down to the upper part of Mexico, but the main part of the population is located in and around Texas, even though the world record was taken in Nassau Sound, 20 pounds, 9 ounces, in 1983. The Texas record, yeah, that's a good size of flounder. It's getting into some other category altogether. It's huge. Right. The Texas record is 13 pounds, 28 inches, and taken in Sabine Lake in 1976. The basic biology that has effect on implications of females, they grow faster, they live longer, and they get bigger, which is about the sum of the deal. I'll give you a little bit more detail here. Females, for example, they can live about 7 years. They reach 10 inches in the first year, then the next year 14, 17, and so on, and can, of course, reach up to about 28 inches. Males, on the other hand, they live about 4 years. They reach 8 inches in their first year, can go up to 14, but really they seldom exceed 12 inches. The point being is that our fishery, commercial and recreational, then, of course, is really heavily prosecuted on that female because the males really don't get up to that 14-inch minimum yet. So we hit the females really hard, and just might assess this. That is an issue we have to contend with when we're dealing with flounders. Their life cycle also has some implications to their management and survivability. They are a mirror image of brown shrimp. They follow each other almost directly. The adult flounder move out offshore in the fall in the big flounder run, which, of course, everyone's nearly familiar with and certainly take advantage of. They go out offshore. They return back in the spring. Now, not many people think about it. We do have a spring flounder run. It's just that it's spread out over a longer period of time. That fall run, of course, is cued to a temperature change, northers and things come through that push them out. The spring is just a broader time, but they do come back in. Of course, they spawn out there. It takes two or three males to work with one female to make sure that they spawn. The larvae drift back into those bays and steadily move up into the bays right along with the shrimp. They follow those shrimp as they move up there because the young flounder feed on shrimp. They like the same bottoms. They're all locked in. When they start to get a little bit larger, they do separate out. The bigger flounder move up into different areas, and they change over from primarily shrimp feeders to mullet and that type of thing. So that life cycle, of course, as you can imagine, has a tremendous impact on its mortality being associated with those shrimp and shrimping. Relative abundance of flounder, this is our records here. We've been concerned about them for some time. We've seen a nice change in the trend of population since the mid-90s. Although this last year, a little bit of a downtick that has us concerned a bit. I was hoping not to see something like that. The one thing that we're seeing was that we have fewer flounder. They're bigger. We're seeing bigger flounder, but fewer, which has some recruitment issues we're going to look at. So we're a little bit concerned. We would prefer not to hit that dip, but they do change. We want to watch them really closely, but that's one of the reasons we are concerned about them. So let's talk a little bit about mortality, fishing mortality. First, let's take a look at our recreational mortality. Of course, we have a bag limit of 10. In your last meeting, you took our made that bag and retention the same, which is helpful. Minimum length 14 inches. Our recreational anglers take about 110,000 fish, about 200,000 pounds annually. From the commercial side, they have a bag limit of 60, the same length limit. They take about 85,000 fish or at 160,000 pounds. They are our most valuable finfish resource. They sell for $2. Right now they're selling about $2.50 a pound, and that price will vary with season, as you might expect. But they are a valuable commodity and an important part of our restaurant's trade. It's interesting how the landings distribute out. For example, the bulk of our commercial landings, 51% out of Aransas Bay and 21% out of San Antonio Bay, it's a mid-coast fishery port from a commercial perspective. But when you look recreationally, it's mostly on the upper coast, where 56% of our recreational take is in Galveston and 16% in Sabine Lake. So it's a little bit of a shift there. It's probably more than likely related to the fact that the bulk of our remaining commercial fin fishermen are in the lower coast. About 80% of our commercial, and they're after black drums. I mean, that's the main thing. They're some found, but they're all located down south. So it probably makes some sense that that's where they pursue the commercial too. But there may be some other reasons that I'm just not aware of. But mortality and the 800-pound gorilla and the mortality issue here with the flounder is not with the recreational, although that accounts for 10% and commercial 8%. The primarily it's bycatch of the shrimp industry. 82% of our mortality comes directly from bycatch of shrimping. Okay, so the basic thrust is if you're going to do something for the population, to restore the population of flounder, then that's your target where you can be most effective. And we have been doing that, of course. We started in 95, and we talked about a little bit earlier this morning or this afternoon about the shrimp license buyback. And of course, that has been progressing as we talked about. In 2000, the commission, you all adopted a series of regulations for the shrimping that really had a great impact. The creation of new nursery areas basically means that there are larger areas within the bays that are not subject to shrimping. And so that certainly gave some relief to not only shrimp, but the flounder that are associated with them. The implementation of the bycatch reduction devices, a big issue there to help bypass some of the bigger shrimp, that was important as well. And of course, the commercial finfish buyback program that started in 2000. We've been proceeding with that and buying back those licenses as well. I think we've purchased around 140 or 150 since that date and moving along.
Adam,
how many? I knew you were going to ask that. I didn't say it because I couldn't remember off the top of my head, but I do have it. You had that look in your eye. I know you're going to get it. Let's see. Out of 549 licenses, we bought 143, 26%. So it has had an impact. You see here in our sampling and the mortality rate from trawler caught flounder has gone down. That's a plus. Another aspect that we're working on as far as now talking about, since we know what the mortality is, what are we trying to do or what are we doing in regards to helping that population rebound or stabilize? Well, one of the areas is in our hatchery system. I don't know if Dr. Vegas, Robert Vegas had the lead in this, which I greatly appreciate. He's been working very closely with UTMSI, Joan Holt, Dr. Joan Holt and others, and looking at how we can deal with flounder in our hatcheries. And they've had some success actually the first time this year. They've really been able to move this forward to the point where they've actually run flounder through the entire cycle, put them in ponds, and taken them out and released them. Now, this is a trial area, and we're not talking industrial scale issues now, but this is a good trial, and it's been kind of, well, I'm sure it's been fun for me to watch. I'm sure it's been a lot of work for those guys. I think we talked at one of our meetings, for example. There are some practical issues here. Like you look at that picture on the lower right when they release the fish, you know, when we have those tanks, maybe we talked about this, but those tanks, you have a big pipe and just flush the fish out of it, and they all kind of try to move this little round fish. But the flounder are not, they're flat. So what happens when they get in the current is they stick to the side. So as the guy says, we need to invent some kind of like fish spatula to have those fish out of those tanks. So there's some practical issues of how to do it, but they are making progress, and this could be an important part of recovery. And so I appreciate it. The work that Robert is doing with his staff.
Yeah.
So, that's a. She may be holding it way out, but that's still a pretty good size flounder by anybody's estimate. So, one of the key questions that you all asked is what should we consider naming this a game fish? What does that do? Well, clearly, one thing it does, it designates legal gear as hook and line only. So, that's one thing it does from that perspective. It certainly means it can't be used for bait, although I don't think that's a big issue, but that certainly is one of the impacts. One of the significant ones for us is it certainly would also redistribute that commercial catch to the recreational catch. I mean, there's about 12 or so percent of that fishery is in commercial, and this would move it over there. Probably would have the biggest effect in that mid-coast area because there's not much commercial activity up north, but there is in the mid-coast, so that might have an impact there, giving those recreational anglers more. It depends on what your goal is with designation of game fish. If your designation of a game fish is to try to help recover the species, I'll go back to that number. In fact, it probably will not, because the issue is the bycatch. Now, if your if you have multiple goals there, you would just like to shift that. You think it's better for whatever purpose, economic or whatever, that just have a recreational fishery for it. Well, that's one aspect of it. If you also want to try to use that to recover species, you have to think about a couple of other things. For example, how do you treat gigging? That's the big issue. How do you treat gigging? Gigging, trying to look up some information on it, this is not your dad's Coleman lantern and sharp stick anymore. These things are pretty sophisticated operations, and just like they seem to go there, you go out to a ranch, I guarantee you go out to a ranch out at night sometimes, it looks like a little city floating around out there, and you wonder how any flounder could get by any of those boats. And so they're pretty efficient. So that would be an issue, because that gigging has certainly been a traditional aspect of the sport side of it, and do you make an exception, or do you not do that? And we haven't done any survey work on it, but when I was gathering up information for this, I did run across a survey on the internet, and this was down in Corpus. And again, this is not our work, and who knows how balanced it is, but I think it's intuitively looks pretty good as far as it's indicative of attitude. For basically, they asked folks what they felt should we name flounders game fish. And you see here that someone said yes, you let continue with gigging, it'd be okay. Well, that's 54%, 27% otherwise. So the point being is that if we consider that action, you're going to have a lot of pros and cons amongst the constituents whether we should do this or should not do this, and that's something that we have to take into account.
Is commercial fishing a flounder? Can they use a gig?
That's what they use. It's a gig. It's basically, I mean, there may be some others, but mostly it's a gigging activity. The only difference between them and, I mean, they may use these types of things. They use a, these boats, and they go after it. And they can carry 60 feet, whoever's got the line. A knot. That's what they can do.
So they got 10 people in there, they can come back
to 600. Well, they have to have 10 commercial fishing licenses. I mean, they have to have a commercial license. But each commercial fisherman may take 60 is a bag.
Are there any numbers on how many fish the commercial fishermen are taking?
160,000, about. That was, I think I showed that a little bit earlier. Let me flip back there and I'll get it for you. Mm-hmm. If I can do it quickly without. Oops. 160,000 pounds.
Wow.
Probably there's a better way to do this more quickly than that. Let's see. Where are we at here? I knew that was a mistake when I should just look it up in the book. Let me get back to getting a quick rerun of this. Okay, and this is the concluding slide. If we were to continue to allow gigging, for example, that was allowed as a recreational activity, what other recreation-based management options would be available? Because if you wanted to name as a game fish but still have some impact on the biology, if you could make a contribution, what other things could you do? Well, you know, clearly there's the standard issue of reduced bag or size limits, but it might be that the bag limit would be so restricted. It would be like going back to duck hunting days when you could take one or two and we would do it. I mean, it could have an impact. So that's not necessarily one that I think would be effective. We would certainly look at it more closely, but that would have to be pretty severe in that perspective. The other option is not necessarily any more inviting, and that is area or seasonal closure. Other states do use that for other species, and this is particular species would be ideal for that because of those flounder runs that happen in the fall. And now there's, I bet Pete is back there. Colonel Flores is wincing because that's a tough issue to deal with, and it would not be a very popular one. And so that's an option that you can look at. So there's some issues there to be considered. With that, this was just a brief kind of give you, if you think about that and give you that type of background as we watch that population, we're certainly going to be watching closely. We'll certainly be willing to discuss it further at any point. And if there's any questions, I'd certainly be glad to try to answer those now.
Thanks, Lee. Any other questions for Larry about fishing out and collecting action? Next up is Mike Berger, President's Recommendation.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Wildlife Division Director, and here this afternoon to talk briefly about the change in the Panhandle pheasant bag limit. A few years ago, you'll recall that we extended the pheasant season from 16 to 30 days in the Panhandle, and at that same time, we reduced the bag limit from 3 roosters daily to 2 roosters daily. The pheasant populations are doing well in the Panhandle, and there's really no reason to maintain a reduced daily bag limit. Our analysis of harvest data over the past years indicates that the long-term average harvest has remained essentially the same regardless of the 16 or 30-day season or 2 or 3 bird daily bag limit. So at your last meeting, you instructed us to put this out for public comment. We have. We have had one public comment, and it is fully in support of this proposal to expand the daily bag limit. So as you can see on the slide, we...
I didn't know the commissioners could vote.
It was an anonymous.
Oh, it was anonymous.
I think it was anonymous, yes.
Of Colorado.
In the Northwest?
So we will extend that to 3 cock pheasants daily and 6 in possession. That concludes that. If you have any questions.
Any questions for Mike on that one? Thanks for
thank you.
For that.
You're on the record.
Did you get that? Well, I guess that would, I'm going to let you make a motion then. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Mike. Next up, item 7, proposed 2006-07 Oyster Fishery Proclamation. Bill? Bill's just glad the flounder was a briefing item, that's all.
Yes, sir. I can see us getting into another long conversation there. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, for the record, my name is Bill Robinson, Chief of Fisheries Enforcement. At the August 25, 2005 Commission meeting, amendments were adopted that created a definition of SAC for measuring oysters taken from Texas waters. The second part of this action was intended to reduce the commercial daily bag limit for oysters to preserve and stabilize the economic value of oysters taken during the open season. However, the language published in the Texas Register only changed the amount of oysters that may be in possession on board a commercial oyster vessel and did not make it clear that 90 sacks was intended to be the daily limit as well. The proposed amendment would correct that error and clarify that the daily bag limit for commercial oyster fishermen is 90 sacks and the daily bag limit for recreational fishermen is 2 bushels, which is equal to 2 sacks. This amendment would also change the recreational limits units from bushels to sacks to remove the possibility of confusion in the fishery that could result from using different units to measure the take. Currently, not more than 90 sacks of culled oysters may be on board a licensed commercial oyster boat. This proposal would clarify that the legal one-day limit is 90 sacks of culled oysters of legal size. This amendment would also clarify the recreational possession limit and allow a person to take in one day or possess not more than 2 sacks of legal-sized oysters. We did not receive any public comments when this was published in the Register. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, why do you have the 2 terms, sack and bushel?
For many years, we referred to oyster measurements as barrels of oysters or bushels of oysters when the industry referred to harvest as sacks. So many sacks per day or so many sacks on board. When they sold them, it would be so many sacks. And we stayed with that bushel and box measurement for years. And so we did some research on it and found out that a box of oysters weighs approximately 110 pounds. And that is equivalent to 1 sack. So we redefined the box of oysters to make it a sack. And that way the industry and us, everybody combined, measures those oysters as sacks. And it makes it a whole lot simpler for everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank
any
you.
Questions for Bill?
Thanks.
No further questions. I'll place that item on Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mike Berger, you're up for number 8, Public Land Proclamation.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, I'm Mike Berger, Wildlife Division Director, and today I want to brief you on the proposed changes to regulations governing public hunting lands, candidate state parks for public hunts, and establish an open season for public hunting lands for 2006-2007. We briefed you on this, these public lands proclamation changes at the last meeting and put them out for comment and back. We are proposed to remove Aquila Wildlife Management Area from the public hunting program. Corps of Engineers has declined to make it available for public hunting. We had 2 comments in favor of this and 9 opposed. From those who use the area and who do not want to see us not have it. So I think that's understandable. Earlier this year, the state park share of management of Matagorda Island was transferred to the Wildlife Division, so this area no longer functions as a state park, and we need to change the name to Matagorda Island Wildlife Management Area. And there were no comments on that proposal. Also, we're removing regulations addressing recreational activities and camping from Section 65192 and creating a new section that deals specifically with recreational activities on wildlife management areas. There were comments on both parts of that, none in favor of the first part, to remove that section, 4 opposed. They didn't give a reason, but we suspect that they thought we were eliminating camping. With that proposal, which in fact is not what happens. The authority moves to this new section. In regard to the new section that would deal specifically with recreational activities, we had 2 in favor, 8 opposed, and the 8 who were opposed generally wanted hunting to be the only activity that would be approved on wildlife management areas rather than allowing hunters to camp or other people to use the areas for other purposes. We're eliminating the waiver of fees for youth and disabled participation in events that are limited to youth or disabled persons or for the purposes of research, education, or charity. The reason is that there are no application or permit fees for such events or activities other than hunting, and thus there is no need for a waiver. So we would eliminate that. And there were no comments on that change. Now we move on to candidate state parks for public hunting this year. There are 42 candidate state parks proposed for hunting in the upcoming season, and they are in your booklet. Of the 42 state parks proposed this year, 40 were hunted last year. One you've already just heard about. We changed Matagorda Island from a state park to a wildlife management area, so it no longer is there. Lake Houston is in the process of a land transfer, so it's removed. Choke Canyon, you heard about earlier from Walt Dabney, is not going to hold hunts this year due to staff time and the high water that was there. Martin Dyes Jr. is still suffering from Hurricane Rita damage and is not available this year. However, we do have 2 new state parks that will be hunted. That's Abilene State Park and Copper Break State Park. Overall, the drawn public hunt positions this year are up 63 positions from last year, and the youth positions this year are up 244 permits from last year due to the creation of 2 new youth categories for youth managed deer hunts. Mike, so that's a good increase.
Abilene State Park is new, and at Copper Breaks?
Copper Breaks and Abilene, yes, sir.
Those only just 2?
The 2 new ones this year. So, and in order to conduct public hunts on public hunting lands, the commission is required to establish an open season for hunting on public lands each year, and this season would be from September 1st, 06 to August 31st, 07, and that will be in the recommendation that will come to you tomorrow. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
You added some exotics at Garner?
We added that's one of those new youth hunting categories, youth exotic categories. So that's part of those 244 new youth positions that we have.
Mike, for the youth season, is that in advance of the regular season, or how did you space that?
No. There are youth seasons in advance and after. These are for drawn hunts. So these can be at any time when the wildlife management area or the state park is open, it's established as a drawn hunt, but specifically indicated for you. So throughout the season. Other questions?
Section 65, when they set out the recreation use of wildlife management area, those other uses other than hunting and fishing, are they allowed if they conflict with hunting and fishing, or is hunting and fishing still the priority use?
No, it's just like any other thing. When there's those activities are ongoing, unless they're restricted to some park, and it's just the hunting that's going on at that time.
Is it fair to say it's a little typical of what we do on state parks where the first objective is outdoor recreation in the state park, and then if it doesn't conflict, you're allowed to hunt. In the case of WMA, it's hunting and fishing. If it doesn't conflict, you're allowed to hunt.
And research and demonstration on most wildlife management areas. But hunting is clearly a part of that research and demonstration. Yes, sir.
Any other questions for Mike? You need to publish that, don't you?
No, we've already published those changes, and I'll come with a recommendation to adopt tomorrow.
Okay.
And you just need to endorse the state park hunts and open the hunting season, so we can have that tomorrow. That'll be in tomorrow's recommendation.
Place on the agenda for public comment and action tomorrow. If there are no further questions. Any other business, Mr. Cook?
No, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Going to business? We're adjourned.